The forecast now from the National Weather Service. Look for a cloudy morning. Still a 30% chance of some scattered light showers, but then a sunny and warm afternoon. How about that? Today's high 72. Tonight, clear and cool, a low of 48. Thursday, partly sunny and seasonal, 60% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high, only 66. Right now, new numbers are in. Humidity sky high at 96%. Wind from the north at 3. It is overcast and 67 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Two interviews about Mark Twain, and then an interview about the Kenosha Symphony, all coming up. It is not every day that an unknown story of Mark Twain comes to the surface and is shared with the world, but that is what has happened. At least that's largely the case with an absolutely beautiful and charming new book called The Purloining of Prince Oleomargarine. And it is written by Mark Twain and Philip Stead. And we will explain that in just a moment. But in the meantime, it is an honor indeed to be speaking with one of America's most highly regarded children's book authors, Philip Stead, responsible for A Sick Day for Amos McGee, Bear Has a Story to Tell, Lenny and Lucy. And this latest book is not only a collaboration with Mark Twain, but also with Philip Stead's talented wife, Erin Stead, who has created the remarkable illustrations for it. This book is from Doubleday. And Philip Stead, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
So glad we can have this conversation. So, this beautiful children's book stems from something of a fragment by the great Mark Twain that only very recently came to light. Explain to our listeners the circumstances under which this unknown bit of writing by Mark Twain finally saw the light of day so many decades after his death.
Yeah, the story of this book really is a little bit of a treasure hunt. Back in 2011... a researcher from Winthrop University, a man by the name of John Bird, went out to the Mark Twain Archive, which is in Berkeley, California, UC Berkeley, and what he was working on there was nothing to do with children's books at all. He was actually working on a Mark Twain cookbook, and so he had the researchers pull up any file folder that had anything at all to do with food. In this case, a file got pulled that probably had not been touched in decades, that was labeled oleomargarine. And when they opened it up, instead of finding anything at all to do with food, what they found were 16 pages of handwritten notes from Mark Twain for a children's story that he had been telling to his own children in the year 1879. This researcher, John Bird, because he was a Mark Twain scholar, recognized immediately the significance of what he had found. A lot of people had known that Twain was in the habit of telling stories to his own children. They also knew a little bit about this story from Twain's diaries and Twain's journals, but nobody really believed that there was any physical evidence remaining well over 100 years later of what this story actually was. And so this was a real eureka moment for Professor Bird.
No kidding. We should probably explain, too, that this amounts to something of a tantalizing glimpse into what was actually a very important part of Mark Twain's life and the collective life of his family. That is, these impromptu stories, some of them quite elaborate, that he told quite often to his daughters. Just tell us what we know sort of collectively about these impromptu stories, what they tended to be like, and how this particular story sort of fits into that largely unknown legacy.
Sure. So Twain was in the habit of telling stories to his children. There was sort of a ritual around it that would happen, you know, almost every night. The girls would come to him at the end of a long day. Usually he's already spent the day writing and he's trying to relax now, but then the girls would sort of flood in to his writing chamber and ask, you know, "Papa, please tell me a story." Often they would bring a magazine with them or a newspaper, and they would open it up and point to an image. And from that image, Twain would be tasked with beginning a story. And a lot of times, you know, it was bizarre stuff. So in the case of The Purloining of Prince Oleomargarine, it was an anatomical drawing of a boy who Mark Twain then named Johnny, and Johnny became the hero of this particular story. Where the word oleomargarine came from, we're not real sure. I tend to believe that the neighboring page on that magazine was an advertisement for margarine. And it's just such a fun word, especially in its original form, oleomargarine, that it just rolls off the tongue beautifully. It just seems like something Mark Twain would pluck and naturally put into his own story, because it would just be funny and it would make the girls giggle. What I love about these moments that we know about with Twain and his family is that it is so much different than the rest of Twain's life. You know, Twain was one of the most famous people on the planet when he was alive. He could not go anywhere without being mobbed by people. And every word that came out of his mouth, even if it sounded off the cuff, I believe was actually considered and careful and measured whenever he spoke. But you have to imagine that when he's at home, that guard comes down and he becomes, instead of being Mark Twain, he becomes Samuel Clemens again. Or in this case, he just becomes Dad or Papa. And because of that, I think that he probably allowed himself to be certain things that he couldn't be in public, that he could be vulnerable, he could be sweet, he could be kind. He was known in public for being witty and acerbic and cutting. And, you know, those things don't necessarily, they're not as important when you're talking to your own children.
Of course.
Especially in a sweet moment at the end of the day when you're all getting along. So,
right.
I just thought it was a fascinating window into the person of Mark Twain that allowed him to become more of a real and fully formed person and less of an icon.
Right. And I love a quote from Mark Twain that appears in the New York Times article that showed up a few months ago about your project, in which he is quoted as saying they, meaning his daughters, were a difficult and exacting audience, those little creatures. The stories had to be absolutely original and fresh. So in other words, the daughters evidently, at least the way Mark Twain describes them, valued a high level of originality and maybe even outrageousness in these stories. And so this probably ended up not being just sort of a tiresome night after night ritual that was boring for him. It was actually something of a stimulating challenge evidently relished.
We tried to keep with that spirit too. You know, we had a couple of choices when we began this project. One would be to try to just predict the way in which Mark Twain would have exactly told this story, which is a very difficult thing to do because he's not necessarily there to consult with. Another way to approach it would be, you know, our background is children's literature, and we were more interested in the children in the room. What would they have asked for, and what would they have wanted in the story? And when we thought about it from that angle, it was much easier for us to find an avenue into this project. Anybody that's ever told a story in the moment, impromptu, in front of children, knows that there are no rules. And there's a great quote from Mark Twain that we put at the front of this book, which is essentially that there is only one law to narrative, and that law is that there is no law. And that could not be more true than when you're telling a story to children.
Absolutely. They don't care about the rules.
In the end, often have, you know, nothing to do with one another.
Right.
It makes it really fun as a storyteller.
Sure. I'm curious to know what these 16 pages are like. That is the raw material that survives, if that was written in any kind of, is it sort of an abridged version of the story, or a story that ends abruptly before it ends? I mean, is it written as a story at all, or is it more like kind of random notes? And also, I know that the scholar who uncovered this, I know that he attempted to fill it out as a story, but that was never, his effort has never been published. I'm just curious if you took even a glance at that, or if your book springs entirely from whatever these notes were from Mr. Twain.
Our version springs entirely from Twain. That was more because we just wanted to make sure that we didn't have too many ideas pouring in as we were trying to also come up with something new. And we also didn't want to copy anybody else's work. We needed to find a way to just work with this, you know, unusual collaborator of Mark Twain. The notes were essentially an outline of plot. So this happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens, which makes sense because if it began as a piece of oral tradition, you wouldn't necessarily need to put down finished prose because you might tell it differently one day to the next. But what you won't tell differently are the major plot points. So it's like almost any folktale then. You need to know where you're beginning and where you're ending, but everything that happens in between is a little bit in flux. However, that said, even Mark Twain's outline, even his notes, were so beautifully written to us that whenever possible, we tried to take those words exactly and find ways to weave them into the manuscript. And a really careful reader, if you look at the notes and then look at the finished book, you'll find those moments where Twain's actual notes verbatim make it in.
Wow. One of the things I love about the book, and I absolutely love the book, is that the style of writing seems to have that quirky twist that we associate with Mark Twain and his utterly unique voice. How difficult was that for you to achieve that?
It was, in some ways, it was natural in that I've always felt a certain affinity to Twain's sense of satire and irony. On the other hand, Mark Twain is a master, and so I didn't take lightly the task of trying to find his voice. We really lucked out, though, because if all we had was Mark Twain's catalog of things that had been published over 100 years ago, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, Innocents Abroad, if that's all we had, it would have been very difficult to find what we really needed to find, which was Mark Twain's actual speaking voice. Luckily for us, Mark Twain had worked on an autobiography that he had stipulated he didn't want published until 100 years after his death. So this is a relatively new book that's come out, actually. What was so fantastic about that autobiography is that he didn't write it, he spoke it. Somebody else wrote it down for him as he was speaking extemporaneously. It's definitely Mark Twain's voice, and you recognize it, but it's also a little bit different than what you might find in his finished prose. There's something more natural and more free-flowing about it, and something a little bit more modern about it, which was helpful to us, too, because we needed to find a way to take Twain's voice and bring it into the 21st century in a way that made it feel new and not necessarily dated, not just like a relic, a dusty relic.
Right. I think I mentioned once, but I certainly want to mention again, that this book marks yet another rich collaboration between you and your wife, Erin Stead. Erin is responsible for doing the illustrations, and they are an indispensable element in the magic of this book. Could you just say a word about the process by which the two of you work together and a book like this takes shape? And who is inspiring whom in terms of how both the visual and textual elements of the book come together?
Sure. I took care of the writing. Erin took care of the art. Mark Twain took care of the ideas. And it really felt like the three of us were in the studio together. As strange as it sounds, Mark Twain really became a physical presence for us by the time we were really underway on this project. Erin and I spend, close to 24 hours a day together, and so sometimes it's difficult to tell, who's been responsible for what idea. in a story. You know, I start to stumble over my words even talking about it because we're just, Aaron and I, both our lives and our art are so intertwined. It was Aaron's idea, though, to make this book into a real picture book, which is something that didn't really necessarily exist in Mark Twain's day. So Mark Twain's day, the writer always took center stage, and if there was artwork in a book, the artwork really behaved more as decoration. So you might get an illustration every 10 pages, or you might just get a little spot illustration at the beginning of a chapter or something like that. And it was just to make the page more lively and a little bit more friendly for children. Today, we're much more accustomed to seeing lavishly illustrated books for children. The heyday of children's literature in the 1950s and 60s really brought the picture book into the forefront as a really important American art form. And we wanted to honor both, you know, Twain's original vision, but also recognize that, you know, we're in a much different time now with children's literature, and we can do things that they couldn't do back then. And so Erin really saw herself as the third author here, telling story with image that we didn't necessarily tell just with the words alone.
Right.
So a lot of choices about what the characters would look like, how you might relate to those characters, really is a product of Erin. And like any good picture book, by the time you're done, you may not have realized that the pictures have told half the story.
Right. I mean, they create this intriguing world. And of course, her spare style also leaves room for our imagination to sort of create what, in a sense, isn't there or isn't there on the surface. Well,
yeah, one of Aaron's favorite things is to just leave an entire field of white paper.
Well, this whole project is beautifully crafted. Again, it's titled The Purloining of Prince Oleomargarine, springing out of an original idea by Mark Twain, written by Philip Stead and illustrated by Aaron Stead, published by Doubleday's Division for Young Readers. Philip Stead, my congratulations to you and your wife on creating this exceptionally wonderful book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me.
And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be examining the life of writer Mark Twain in contrast to the only other American living at the time who was equally colorful and equally well-known, Theodore Roosevelt. The book at hand is called Mark Twain and the Colonel, Samuel L. Clemens, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Arrival of a New Century. In Philip McFarlane's fascinating book, we not only examine these two remarkable men, but also the remarkable times in which they came to prominence. And McFarlane examines the really intriguing relationship between Mark Twain and Theodore Roosevelt, a relationship that at times was warm and friendly, and that at other times was quite turbulent. We began our conversation by talking about the book itself and the fact that Philip McFarlane actually initially set out to write quite a different book from the one that he ultimately wrote.
Well, I was originally planning to do a book just on Mark Twain, to complete a trio of books that I had in mind to carry my consideration of American literary figures through the 19th century into the 20th century. I had started with Hawthorne, who was born in 1804, then Harriet Beecher Stowe, born in 1811, and she died in 1896, and Mark Twain was born in 1835, and he lived on into the 20th century and died in 1910. But while I was embarked on that hope of writing a book on Mark Twain, I came upon an opinion that Mark Twain expressed about Theodore Roosevelt. And he wrote not for his own readership, but for readers 100 years after his death. He wrote that Roosevelt was, and this is a quote, "far and away the worst president we have ever had." And I wondered why he, who knew Roosevelt well and was watching the tenure of Roosevelt in the White House unfold, felt so strongly and so negatively about a man who, as of now, is regarded as one of our five greatest presidents. And that was what set me off to spend 5 years researching the relationship between the two and writing the book.
I suppose part of what would make that assessment by Samuel Clemens a bit of a surprise is the fact that at a glance, Mark Twain and Theodore Roosevelt, although there are plenty of obvious differences, also seem to share a lot of similarities, both being progressive thinkers, for one thing, and both, of course, inquisitive and intelligent and so on. So one might blithely assume that there would have been nothing but admiration between the two of them.
Yes, some of those similarities might have been a little hard for each to recognize in the other. For example, both loved to be in the spotlight and were uneasy when the spotlight moved away from them. Both were monologuists. They were wonderful conversationalists, and they were listened to raptly, but they enjoyed being the center of attention in any conversational situation. They were both very young in spirit and remained young to the end of their days, which may have been a secret of their great appeal, because in a childlike way they kept seeing the world freshly. So there were similarities, as you say, but there were very marked differences as well.
Mm. I would appreciate it if you would sort of take us inside your own head as you decided to write your book as you did. I mean, to not focus on Samuel Clemens specifically, but to compare these two men and to sort of draw parallel lines between their respective lives. That had to be a complicated task, different from any of the books you'd previously written. Can you just sort of share with us how you wrestled with exactly how to do this, how to put this book together, how to shape it and construct it in such a way that it would make sense to you and to us as the readers?
Well, it's always something of a mystery how these things unfold. I've always, in all of my books, wanted to write more than a simple biography. I want to write about the times that the individual lived in as well. I'm as interested in the times as in the individual lives. The times in which Mark Twain and Theodore Roosevelt lived had their overlapping encounters with each other were such significant times in shaping the nation that we live in, 1890 to 1910. It soon became apparent to me, was filled with so much of interest, the technological advances then, that the very names Edison and Rockefeller and Carnegie and J.P. Morgan and the Wright brothers and Henry Ford bring to mind. Movies came into being during that time. The electric light, the phone became ordinary and most household commonplace. So many transformations of life that reminded us, me at least, of so much that was going on now, how rapidly America has changed in the last 20 or 30 years. The relevance of the times to our own times was what absorbed me. And because of that, and because Mark Twain and Roosevelt both were constantly astute observers of what were going on, saw things from different points of view, and yet had something to say about every major issue of the time, led me to become intrigued by how they would reflect these very significant years in what to me was a fascinating way.
Mm-mm. I believe at one point you tell us that 23 years separated Clemens and Roosevelt. That is, Samuel Clemens was 23 years older than Theodore Roosevelt. So although we're speaking of them collectively as sort of rising to prominence at roughly the same point in our country's history, in fact, they were, one could say, almost part of two different generations. Can you just say a word about that? I mean, about the significance, if there is great significance, in the fact that there was that kind of age difference between them. In what way did that shape who they were and the differences between them?
That's certainly a key point in understanding the contrast. Mark Twain was at his domestic prominence in the 1880s, in the 1870s and 80s, when he had a mansion in Hartford, Connecticut, and was in his absolute prime. Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, Life on the Mississippi, The Prince and the Pauper, all of these books came out in the 1880s, 1870s, and 80s. And Roosevelt, as a young man then, read and adored all of those books. So he had a great admiration and love for Mark Twain, as so many other millions did. The feelings that Mark Twain had for Roosevelt as an individual, he met him first in mid 1880s, were very favorable. He said, for example, and I'm quoting, "Mr. Roosevelt is one of the most likable men that I'm acquainted with," and he said that as late as 1906. So his objections to Roosevelt were by no means personal. Every time he shook his hand, he said, he felt an electric charge go up his arm. He did feel, however, and this addresses the issue that you raised about the difference in their ages, that Roosevelt wasn't behaving in a presidential way. He was the youngest chief executive we've ever had. He came into the White House when he was 42, the youngest to assume the office before or since. And he didn't behave the way others before him had behaved. Those of long memories who recall when Kennedy came into the White House can relate to that feeling of exuberance that America had by the youth entering the White House. And that was a little hard for Mark Twain to stomach, because TR just did not seem presidential in the old-fashioned way. He lacked dignity. He was rambunctious. He did things that no other president had done. He was the first to leave the United States and go down to investigate the Panama Canal, which Roosevelt was primarily responsible for our setting out to dig. He was the first to hold press conferences, to call the press in and talk with them, and he did it day by day, and kept his name in front of the nation accordingly. This didn't seem presidential. So the difference in their ages of close to 25 years was significant in explaining why there was a difference in their regard for each other. Roosevelt was of more of the 20th century, and Mark Twain was more of the 19th, and it was hard for Mark Twain to make the adjustment. He said as much. "I wish this new century well," he said in effect, "but my century is the 19th. I took 65 years of it." He was born in 1835, and if I'd known what I know now, I would have taken the whole of it.
Hmm. Another intriguing difference between the two of them is, of course, the circumstances under which they were raised, their respective childhoods. That is, one was essentially a rural childhood, and the other was urban. And you spend two chapters of the book sort of outlining some of the interesting differences between the two. One of the most intriguing questions revisited in your book again and again is that of race. And you've already mentioned the fact that Theodore Roosevelt grew up in an abolitionist family. And yet, Theodore Roosevelt, when it came to regarding other races, had some attitudes that we might find surprising, I mean, given that background. Can you say a word about sort of what surprises us about Theodore Roosevelt and his attitudes when it came to other races? I mean, it feels at odds with so much of the rest of what we know about him.
He was very much a child of his times, and quite a sophisticated child of his times, the most advanced scientific thought was what he was informed about and what he subscribed to, and that had to do with an understanding that there were five races, sometimes they said six, sometimes seven, but that these races were each quite distinct from one another, with separate strengths and weaknesses, and that the races, like everything else in this post-Darwinian world, were evolving. And if they were evolving, some of the races were very far advanced, and others were not advanced at all. And Roosevelt subscribed to all this, and he felt that the Anglo-Saxon race, what he sometimes referred to as the English-speaking race, so that his Dutch Teutonic forebears did not exclude him from it, were the most advanced of the races. And they demonstrated this by their values of democracy, of rule of law, of trial by jury, and all kinds of organizational devices that they had developed in advance of all other races, as they understood the term. The least advanced were the African races, and Roosevelt felt that this was an accurate description of the present state, that is 1900, let's say, of world evolution. He was under no delusions about the fact that this was an ongoing movement and that things could change, that all these races and all civilizations went through stages and degeneracy could set in with any advanced race. In fact, there was always the risk that a civilization would get too civilized and become effete again and become and then lose its strengths and disappear. And he also felt strongly that there were many, many individual exceptions to any such generalizations about races. But when he was considering race as a whole, he felt it was accurate, scientifically verifiable, and a lot of people were engaged in the scientific verification, measuring skulls, weighing brains, doing all kinds of things to evaluate which of the races were more advanced and which were less advanced. And despite these generalizations that he subscribed to, Roosevelt insisted that you judge an individual on his or her merits and not on any kind of preconceived notions that, say, one's race would suggest. Hence Booker T. Washington. He considered a superior human being, and there were many others in the African-American race, as in the Slavic race and in the Mexican race and in the Russian race, although he thought of all of the Russians, he thought not very warmly toward them, but individual Russians, cultured Chinese, educated Japanese, his Harvard classmate who was an educated Japanese he admired, and so on. So that his final say on what was considered the problems of races was the only thing you can do is judge a man on his merits and treat him as those merits dictate he should be treated. That was his final word on it. But you're quite right that it is disturbing to read these assertions of his and realize that they were progressive thoughts in his time.
Philip McFarlane's book is Mark Twain and the Colonel, Samuel L. Clemens, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Arrival of a New Century. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That wonderful music is from the last movement of the Violin Concerto in G minor of Max Bruch, and that is going to be one of the featured works for the opening night concert of the Kenosha Symphony, and none other than Frank Almond, concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony, will be on hand. But in the meantime, we are talking not so much about that concert specifically today, that we'll leave for another morning show, but rather we're going to be talking about a special event that is coming up to help kick off this new season, a major fundraiser for the Kenosha Symphony. And Thea Keshavarsi, who is the president of the board, is joining us here in our studios. And we should mention that Thea Keshavarsi, as I'm sure many of you know, also plays with the Kenosha Symphony in the cello section. It's good to welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good, good. So it's no small feat to keep track of all that's going on with the orchestra and also to play in it. So you must be a busy woman.
I am very busy.
But happy. I know that the symphony means a lot to you, and you've worked tirelessly on its behalf. And on the eve of another season, I know you are excited about a lot of different things. But let's start, first of all, with this big event that is coming up on Sunday, the 15th of October. Explain to our listeners what's going to what will happen on the 15th.
The 78th season of the symphony, Inspiring Minds, Igniting Hearts, will begin October 15th at Uline's new conference center in Pleasant Prairie. The event is from 5 till 8 o'clock, and it will include a silent auction, some really great food, a cash bar, along with music of Southport Sound.
Ah.
Included in this, too, is a behind-the-scenes look at the orchestra via the photography of Julia Schiller, and her photography will actually be also on sale. And she took photographs behind the scenes, and she has done some really cool things with it. And so you'll have an opportunity to see that and an opportunity to purchase those pictures.
Oh, cool. So in other words, at, I suppose, various rehearsals of the orchestra, maybe even performances or so on, she was snapping pictures to backstage. Oh, a neat idea. Yeah. Absolutely wonderful idea. And so this is an opportunity for people to support the Kenosha Symphony and also to enjoy a little peek at what goes on and some of the people who are on that stage that we typically only see from a distance. And so again, this is going to be Sunday, October 15th, and the time is, you said, at 5 to 8 p.m.?
Yes.
Very good.
A little bit about the Southport Sound. I think that they're pretty familiar in Kenosha.
Mm-hmm.
They play at Fusion once a month, and so the band is made up of 9 instrumentalists and a vocalist, and they're going to play big band sounds as well as contemporary music. And if people would like to join along and dance, they're welcome to. It's just going to be a really, really fun night.
Super. So, again, Sunday, October 15th is a chance to have some fun and also support the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. How do people get tickets for the event on the 15th?
Okay, tickets are $75 per person, or if you desire $100, and $25 of that will be contributed to help defray the costs. Tickets can be purchased on our website at www.kenoshasymphony.org. And then once you're in the website, go to the tab that says box office, and you'll be able to purchase your tickets there. You can also send a check to the Kenosha Symphony office, which is at 723 58th Street in Kenosha, 53140. Or you can call the symphony office. It will take your credit card number and process it at 262-220-7526.
Very good. Of course, what we also want to take a little bit of time to talk about is the symphony's season, the actual music making, which is, of course, what it's all about. And this fundraiser helps to make all of that possible. So, as we mentioned, the first concert is going to be coming up on the 28th of October, and I know you're especially excited about the headliner soloist who is part of that concert.
We really are. That concert's at 7:30, and it's at Reuther High School. And the soloist is Frank Almond from the Kenosha Symphony, and he is a wonderful player, needless to say. He's a charming gentleman, and it's just going to be a whole lot of fun. He's playing the Brook Violin Concerto. And in conjunction with that, we will be playing the last two symphonies of Mozart, one before the violin and one after.
So Symphony 40 and Symphony 41, two of his very, very best. And yes, Frank Almond, concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, really, really superb artist. And, of course, also someone who made headlines for kind of an unhappy reason a few years back when he was attacked and his beautiful violin was stolen. Thankfully, that was recovered. He wasn't seriously injured. He has made a tremendous recovery from all of that, playing as well as ever, and is just one of the finest artists here in southeastern Wisconsin. So what a pleasure that we can encounter his artistry in this concert coming up on Saturday night, the 28th of October. And, of course, it'll be Maestro Robert Hasty on the podium, music director of the Kenosha Symphony, conducting. Tell us about the rest of the season.
The second concert is on December 9th, and that's at 2:30. And we're doing a real, true Holiday Pops concert this year. It's sponsored by our friends at Snap-on, and we expect many Snap-on employees to be there. And we are also joined by the Kenosha Chamber Choir.
Mm-hmm.
And this choir is really very good. Mm-hmm. And it's hardly even a chamber choir anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just getting bigger and bigger. So that's going to be a lot of fun. There'll be a sing-along, and all the traditional holiday music will go on there.
Very good. So that's been scheduled, obviously, for is that Sunday afternoon or
Saturday
afternoon? Saturday afternoon at 2:30. So
it's all for families.
Right. Designed so it's easy to get kids there, and people young and old alike can come and enjoy that concert. Again, that's Saturday afternoon, December 9th.
I would like to say we have got a nice grant from the Kenosha Chamber, and once again, all students 18 years and younger are admitted to the concerts free.
Fantastic. That is such a great thing. All right, and what comes after that then?
Our final concert is on April 14th at 7:30, and we'll be performing at Carthage College in their chapel. We are joined, well, first of all, we're celebrating Beethoven. We'll be playing the first Beethoven symphony and then the C major mass, and we will be joined by the Carthage College Choir and the Tremper High School Chorale. And both of these choruses are really top-notch, and it's going to be a really great concert. And that is, once again, at Carthage College.
And this is similar to a couple of other collaborations that have occurred, which have combined the Carthage Choir with an area high school choir, and Tremper is one of the best. And
So that's going to be a very, very exciting experience. And I know personally from knowing some of the students who have taken part in for instance, the most recent such collaboration, that it was something that really meant a lot to these young singers in high school to be up on the risers with collegiate singers and also singing great, great music with a fine orchestra. So it's a win-win all around. What's the date of that once again?
April 14th.
Very good.
7:30.
Great. So an exciting season stretches ahead for the Kenosha Symphony and music director Robert Hasty. And is there anything else you need to tell us about?
I would like to talk a bit once more a little bit about raising funds and the importance to the community of raising funds. In these days of divisiveness and uncertainty, a professional symphony enhances the quality of life in our community. It increases the vitality, provides a sense of belonging, and creates unity. Kenosha area enjoys these benefits by having the Kenosha Symphony serve as the pillar of the community. It takes approximately $25,000 to present each concert by the time you pay the musicians, print programs, all the back behind the scenes activities. And so that sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money, but this is why we are trying to raise the funding. The orchestra has many generous individual contributors, and we hope that they will be able to come to the fundraiser so we can meet and thank them in person. One really, really good thing about the Kenosha Symphony contributors is whether it's $10 or $1,000. I mean, I get as excited with the $10 donations as I do with the big ones. They're really, really good audience support. And we also are striving to nurture partnerships with businesses in the Kenosha area, and so they can be concert sponsors, or we can get smaller donations from various businesses and put them all together to be a concert sponsor. And we are very grateful for the partnership that we are forming with Uline. They have opened us with wide arms to use their conference center, and it's very beautiful if you come. It's fall, and the conference center is all glass, and it looks out into these woods, and we're hoping that the lights will be, or the leaves will be turning. And it's just really going to be a fun night. And we have some really good silent auction items.
Great. So we want to remind people again of that, that's Sunday, October 15th, 5 to p.m. in the conference center at Uline. And if people want tickets, they're probably the simplest thing is to go to the Kenosha Symphony website. And you can get information there on purchasing tickets ahead of time. And then, of course, the season itself gets underway on October 28th. And we look forward to connecting with violinist Frank Almond and having a conversation with him about his performance that helps kick off this 78th season of the Kenosha Symphony. Remind our listeners again of the phone number at your office and also of the address of the Kenosha Symphony's website.
The phone number is 262-220-7526, and the address is 723 58th Street in Kenosha. And that's 53140. And we encourage people to purchase tickets soon so that we know how many people are be there and we can plan to have adequate food and entertainment and whatever else. It's really going to be a fun night.
Great. Thea Akishavarzi is the president of the board of directors of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. Great to connect with you again. We hope that your fundraiser is very successful, and I, for one, am looking forward very much to all of the concerts that are coming up this season with the Kenosha Symphony. Best wishes to you.
Thank you.
A little more of the Max Bruch violin concerto, which will be played by Frank Almond on the Kenosha Symphony's first concert. We look forward to speaking with Frank Almond sometime in the next couple of weeks. He is also about to perform with the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. Tomorrow on the morning show, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Anthony Bonhart, assistant professor of psychological science, talking about